I forget what we were talking about. We were talking about the comparison of the working day, I think, between the sales department and then when you went to work for Mr. Whittaker. And we were talking about how it was slightly more flexible, your day, when you worked for Mr. Whittaker. Would you generally finish at 5 at the end of the day?
No, I think this was the start of me finishing when the work was done, whenever that was. He was pretty considerate, and he would do his best. There was always a rush to get the post done in order to send it down to the post office on the lower floor to get it stamped and sent out. So to that end, he had to be punctual. But there were times when I was left with getting it posted myself on the way home. But he did his best. He was one of the more considerate directors in that respect. And I generally left on time, but I wouldn't have questioned it if I had to stay late.
No one's mentioned the post room before. Was it you that actually went down to the post room itself to take the correspondence?
Yes. I think it was hazy memories, but I think it was part of the filing office. It was on the ground floor, and I believe it was opposite the office held by the company secretary. And they did filing, believe it or not, in there as well. They filed a copy of everything, and they had a big franking machine. So at about, 4:30 every evening, everything to go out into day's post had to go through the franking machine.
And that was done by hand, was it? There was no automation in those days.
That was done by hand, yes, yeah.
And was that the same with the sales when you were working for Garfield James? You would have taken the correspondence down for that as well?
Oh, yes, we didn't actually have to do that. We had a system of trays on our desks. As old-fashioned in-tray, out-tray, filing tray. And girls from the post department would come down, up, in my case, at fairly regular intervals, and they would take the inter-office memos round, and they would take the post. So they probably did 4 or 5 trips a day just collecting posts from our in-trays.
Do you remember how many of them would have worked in the post room in total?
I doubt if it was more than perhaps 2 girls and the senior filing clerk, post woman.
So that's still a substantial amount of correspondence and work they were getting through every day to collect that much correspondence and frank it all and do the filing.
From memory, there would have been a huge amount. I mean, it would have been staggered throughout the day. But, I mean, it would be nothing for me personally to send out 20 or more letters, not including all the little memos. And then there was the 3 other secretaries working for 6 other engineers. There would have been a huge amount of post.
And when you said it was 20 letters, that was when you were working for Mr. Whittaker, was it? Was it about the same when you were working for Garfield James as well?
That was for Mr. James, and I don't think it diminished much from Mr. Whittaker. Perhaps a little, but not much. Yeah.
Is there anything else about the kind of routines of working for Garfield James and Mr. Whittaker that you'd like to add, or perhaps anything that's was unusual or sticks in your mind when you worked for either of those?
Not for the sales. I think I've covered that. I do remember one interesting highlight working for Mr. Whittaker. I knew very little about it, but there was some function on in the works akin to workers' playtime. Have you heard about that?
I have, but I'd love to hear how you experienced it.
I heard nothing, really very little about it at all, except that we had a celebrity, Noel Gordon from Crossroads. And my boss, Mr. Whittaker, I believe, took her out to lunch. Could have been other people with him. And it was just interesting to see how our very austere, forbidding directors were quite overcome with celebrity. And they thoroughly enjoyed taking Miss Gordon out to lunch.
Were you one of the people? Did you actually see the performance in the canteen of Workers' Playtime yourself?
No, I was sales staff Mr. Whittaker at that time. No, we would not have gone down. Too busy.
It's a shame you didn't also get to go for that dinner as well.
Definitely, yes. No, I would have been too intimidated.
And so you moved from working for Garfield James to work for Mr. Whittaker. We've talked a lot about Mr. Whittaker. Just before we move on from those two people, what was it like to work for Garfield James? What was he like as a man?
He was very nice, very considerate. He wasn't always healthy, which is... I used to suffer badly from back problems and neck problems. But I believe he's still alive today, so, you know, he's obviously healthy. He was an extremely nice, considerate boss. Very caring of the people that worked for him while I was with him. I believe after I left, he went on to become a director. But that was after I left. Another difference in the work we did, when I moved up to Mr. Whittaker, we were also responsible for arranging accommodation for anybody who visited the company or for when our bosses went away. So it was a regular thing to be ringing up. I think it was the Queen's in Cheltenham they liked to put a lot of people up at. And there was a very smart hotel at Sherdington, whose name I've forgotten. So yes, we all had to make sure that their accommodation was top-notch.
It's a long way to come from the Queen's Hotel in Cheltenham to Fielding and Platt every day, but I guess they wanted to give that impression of opulence, of nothing but the best for the clients who you would have been arranging accommodation for.
Definitely. I don't remember booking anybody in at a Gloucester hotel. Yes, the Sherdington Hotel was the Greenway. I think it was also a country club at the time. Very smart. You'd only choose... This was in Mr. Whittaker's time, so it would have been the fellow directors or people of similar seniority that he was putting up.
Do you remember any people or companies in particular for whom you arranged accommodation?
Only really the South Wales Company, Bird Brothers, and I think the director was Tommy Bird, but that's the only one I clearly remember.
And did they stay for a long time when they came to visit Fielding's?
Only one day, 2 days at a time, yeah.
And how many times would they have come in your memory?
Some visitors would perhaps only come once, but Bird Brothers, I think, were pretty regular visitors. They came frequently, keeping an eye on what was going on with their project, whatever it was. And similarly, Mr. Whittaker or other engineers visited them frequently.
That's very interesting. You mentioned using the telephone, and I suppose as a secretary, you would have had experience of using telephones at Fielding and Platt. Was there a telephone exchange? Was there an operator who directed calls around the works? Say you wanted to ring another part of the works. How would that have been achieved?
Yes, there was a main telephone operator. She had her own room. I wish I could remember her name. But she was extremely efficient, very competent, I only remember her being there. No other relief telephonist. I suppose there must have been. And she clearly dealt with all outside calls and internal ones. You weren't able, I don't think, to dial yourself from inside. I remember on the director's corridor having a phone with four buttons on it. Yes, by the time I got to the director's corridor, I could dial a button for my own outside line and I could bypass her. But for the internal lines, you pressed a button and she would connect you to any other internal phone in the works.
And where was the telephone exchange situated? Could you describe that for us, please?
I believe it was on the ground floor, overlooking the director's car park, not far from the company secretary's office, I believe.
Did you ever have occasion to go and see the telephonist in person?
Only very occasionally, and not enough to recall what it looked like, no.
That's wonderful, Judith, that you remember what it was like to use the telephones and the telephone exchange, because no one else has obviously had occasion to use the phones around Fielding and Platt, so it's brilliant that you can remember, remember that. Fantastic. Any other details that we might want to touch on about your work for Garfield James and for Mr. Whittaker?
I don't think so. The company cars were always interesting. They were also very hierarchical. Mr. James, being a sales manager, got a standard Vanguard, I believe, in blue. Mr. Whittaker, being a director, got an S-type Jaguar. This went on up the scale. I think Mark Phillips had a Mark 10 Jaguar. Mr. Fielding, there were two company Rolls Royces. And I believe the registration was G2, something like that. And he had a chauffeur, Arthur Davis. And occasionally he would drive his own Rolls, but more often it was the chauffeur. And occasionally when Arthur Davis was waiting for him, he would come up and chat to us secretaries if he was bored. He was a very nice man. He had an incredible stutter, which would have been quite a handicap to him. But I suppose as a chauffeur, he did very well. Certainly Mr. Fielding was quite happy with him. And then there was Mr. Fielding's other car. Yes, this is where I'm remembering G90. It was a long, low Ford, about that high off the ground. Oh, what was the make of it?
It was a Model T, as I recall.
Might be. That sounds a bit too modern and... This was long and low and sleek in British racing green. And how he got himself in and out of it, I don't know. All the Fielding cars were serviced by Colwell's, which was the garage on the corner long ago. And when Mr. Fielding's Ford got as far as Colwell's, it was about that time you could hear the roar of its engine as it came on up Baker Street and parked. And at least as a secretary, you had plenty of warning if you were working for him that day and could belt down to his office. GT40. That's what it was, a Ford GT40.
You're absolutely right. Yes, I remember that now. Can you describe what it sounded like, that engine?
Just a roar, like a racing car starting off. It wasn't like an ordinary car. It was like nothing else we heard in the car park. It was as if you were revving up on a Grand Prix circuit, which, of course, he was used to that. He used to drive Bugattis, didn't he? So, yes, he was fond of his cars.
I remember one other person who talked about the GT40 saying that it was said that when he started up his GT40 that it could be heard in Cheltenham.
Well, yes. I just said Colwell's garage, but probably, yes, probably. Yes, it was huge, the sound. It sounded wonderful, actually, wonderful. I never saw anybody else in it other than him. Would have been wonderful to have had a lift in that thing, yes.
You would have certainly got to where you needed to be quickly, because I understand he was quite a speedster.
He was, yes, yes, he loved speed, hence, you know, from his Bugatti days, yeah.
And just picking up on a person you mentioned, Arthur Davis, his chauffeur, and you mentioned that he would come up and sometimes chat with you and the secretaries when he had a free moment. You've described him as a lovely man with his stutter. I'm just wondering how regularly he would have been able to come up and talk to you. Was it every so often, or was there a particular time when he would have always come to see you?
No, he had no schedule. I don't think anybody who worked for Jim Fielding could have a schedule. He would come up perhaps a couple of times a week, but not at any particular time. It just happened to be if he was waiting for Mr. Fielding and Mr. Fielding wasn't ready, he'd just come and hope for some gossip to no avail at all with us secretaries, but pass the time while he waited at random times.
Do you remember, did he ever mention where he was driving on a particular day, or, you know, what his day might have involved?
Not really. There were frequent trips to London. Mr. Fielding was on a lot of committees in London. He was on what I seem to remember was called a NEDI, National Economic Development Council, and there were little NEDIs as well. He was also a member of the Economic League, Institute of Directors, Federation of British Industries, and for all those things he would have London meetings. I think more often than not he would go. Arthur Davis would drive him up in the car, possibly the train occasionally, but more often it was by car. And then, of course, he'd visit all the other companies in the group.
So Arthur Davis was kept a busy man.
I should think he was very busy. And even when he wasn't busy, he had to be on standby. just in case.
And where would he have been on standby? Did he have anywhere that he could wait in particular? Would he wait in the garages with the cars?
Yes, I believe he was in the garages with the cars. He also occasionally got time to clean the cars in between times, yes, and there were three of them. Occasionally he got the GT40, but there were the two roles. So, down in the garage.
And he wouldn't have done any maintenance on the cars themselves. That would have been done by Colwells.
Yeah. Yes, Colwells. Mm. I never saw him out of uniform. He always had a smart blue uniform, blue peak cap, just as a chauffeur should.
That's wonderful. No one's talked about Arthur Davies before, or indeed his uniform or what he was like. So it's fantastic that you remember him. That's fantastic. Moving on from your time with the sales manager, Mr. James, and with Mr. Whittaker, where did you move on to after that? After we talked about them creating a role for you after Mr. Whittaker left.
Well, I stayed in exactly the same office, which I shared with Mr. Roll's secretary. He was the managing director and technical manager. So we two girls shared an office. Mr. Fielding's secretary had her own private office down the far end. So I stayed in that office because I was still technically a director's secretary, even though Mark Phillips only came in once or twice a week. And then I would work for Ron Green down on the lower floor. As time went by, I got more and more and more work for Mark Phillips. So it wasn't long before I had to stop working for Christopher Manners. And eventually, after about a year, I had to stop working for Ron Green. And I was then exclusively Mark Phillips' secretary. And he lost his secretary at Heenan and Froude. That's their head office in London. This was a huge break for me, because he then allowed me to travel up to Worcester two or three times a week. So I was his only secretary, but divided my time between Worcester and Gloucester.
If we just touch on your time with Ron Green and Christopher Manners, they were the chief engineer and chief designer at that time, were they?
Ron Green was definitely chief engineer. He later also became a director. I cannot remember Chris Manners' job. And I have to say, I think his work was deeply boring after some of the other stuff I was doing. I wasn't unhappy not to be doing that anymore. I don't remember what it was. I think there were a lot of minutes of meetings. But they were lesser meetings, ones that he had taken the notes from, and he just dictated them to me.
And what else would you have done for Christopher Manners, as well as type up meetings? What was the nature of your work for him?
Very little else, very little else. He didn't need much. I don't think I did any correspondence for him. Purely meetings, inter-office memos, bit of filing, not a lot else.
And was that the same with Ron Green as well?
Ron Green was, no, that was more. It was much more technical because he was the chief engineer. It was mainly correspondence, some meetings. Again, not exciting because it was very technical.